Well, as I just stated, I've started the recording. So hello, everybody, and welcome to Open Access Week. Today, we continue our week of sessions on open access issues and opportunities with a presentation from the president of Athabasca University, Dr. Fritz Panikuk. The recording and PowerPoint slides for this presentation and all of the presentations this week are being archived on AU Space, which is Athabasca University's own open access repository. So if you were unable to attend one of our previous sessions, you can still access the Illuminate recording and audio recording from the open access website, and I'll give you the link to that right now. There we go. During the presentation, there will be opportunities for questions and comments, and we invite you at that time to use the microphone in Illuminate by clicking on the microphone icon in the bottom left corner of your screen. Please remember to click on it again when you're done speaking in order to free it up for someone else. You can also let us know that you're waiting to speak by clicking on the hands up icon in the bottom left corner of the participant box. If you don't have audio capabilities, you can also text questions and comments in the text box, and we'll try to stay on top of those. Finally, at the end of the session, we'll be doing a draw for an Athabasca University t-shirt and coffee mug, so stick around and see if you're the lucky participant. Now, I'd like to introduce today's presenter, Dr. Fritz Panikuk. Prior to his appointment as president of Athabasca University in 2005, Dr. Panikuk had been the director of information resources at the University of Calgary, with academic appointments in the Faculty of Communications and Culture and in the Department of History. But it was as the director of information resources that he really helped transform the university from a traditional print-based institution to one that's now a leader in digital learning. And during that time, he also became the chair of the Alberta Library and helped bring to fruition the Synergies Project, which is a nonprofit platform for the publication and the dissemination of research results in social sciences and humanities. In more recent years, Dr. Panikuk has contributed to the growth of Athabasca University as a research and open access institution through the planning and construction of the new Academic and Research Center, and also, of course, with the launch of AU Press. Dr. Panikuk is recognized nationally for internationally for his leadership in the creation of digital resources, digital communication, and the transformation of academic publishing. And in 2008, he was asked to stand as president of the International Council for Open and Distance Education, which is headquartered in Oslo, Norway. So we're very pleased, Dr. Panikuk, that you were able to take the time to join us once again for Open Access Week this year. And I don't want to take up any more of your time, so I'll hand over the mic to you.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a discussion this morning is likely to be more of a ramble than something with very explicit explicit points. So what I'm really interested in and what I want to reflect on is learning in what I call the digital revolution, a revolution that I sometimes think is over and it's now in its winter years or winter months. But in fact, I'm continually surprised at how in parts of the world it still is in its infancy. The other thing that's happening around the world, which is of great concern to me, is that as digital environments become more pervasive, that governments are increasingly regulating those environments and what you can do with them. In fact, some countries like Ethiopia, as the latest, as you probably all know, has decreed that distance education is not going to be something that they support. In fact, they're going to work against. And there's also increasing regulation in other parts of the world. And today, as we watch what's going on in the U.S., we will see increasing regulations because of some of the activities of some of the private for-profit providers, and that's going to impact how a lot of people might ultimately use digital digital materials. Well, we all know what the promise of the digital revolution is. We all believe, and we're all converts, so I feel like I'm talking to the people who already know. It's learning is going to be all of the things in that list, from accessible to infinitely more open, more socially engaging. And unfortunately, the one item I didn't put down here, but increasingly it's what conventional universities and some of the other sectors believe, and it is going to be more profitable. If you do it right, I can show you, yes, it could be, but it also could be infinitely more expensive. So it all depends on what your investment interests are. The real challenge internationally and the real opportunity for places like Athabasca or for North America and the developed world is you can see these numbers on this slide. From the 28 million students in 1970 to 152 today, and in another decade from now, that 152 million is supposed to be close to 300 million students. Well, it doesn't take much to figure out that the only way you can manage another 150 million students is using technologies. Because the only way you can get the faculty out to those students is using the technologies. The only way you can get the infrastructure out is the technologies. Some countries I've dealt with recently have said, we can't go the digital way because we can't afford the infrastructure. I said, so you can afford a new university that may cost you $700-800 million, but you can't afford the $200,000 to $300,000 to put a wireless system in. So you know, where are the priorities? And they still don't see that like wireless or that infrastructure is an infrastructure that is one that is as important as let's say the bricks and mortar institutions. It's very interesting to see those, and those attitudes are pervasive in our own country. They're not only pervasive elsewhere. Well, and you also know some of these graphs is where is the growth going to be? The growth is going to be very modest in North America. You can see the very bottom line. It's going to be very aggressive in Asia, extremely aggressive. It's going to be China and India, Africa, Latin America as well. Largely it's going to be an Asian-led change. And we have to be very aware of that. Well, as we know that the institutions around the world have to meet the challenge of these increasing numbers, and how can they do so at reasonable cost? How can they do so when they don't have the faculty in place? How can they do so when they don't have the culture of intellectual inquiry in place? And I think those are some of the key challenges. Most recently, I was fortunate enough, and some of you are aware of this, to be talking to the Nepalese diaspora and the government of Nepal about building their capacity through an open university. That's a huge challenge to that country, and I think, and they acknowledge that ICTs are the only way it's going to happen. Well, most of you are also aware of the users, the ICT users. This graph is or chart is really, really interesting because if you look at both the penetration rate and the total use rate, well, obviously Africa is down there at the bottom, but Asia has 42% of the world users, but they only have 19% penetration rates. So you imagine if that's going to get to the North American and rate, 70 to 80%, we're going to have the web and ICTs dominated by certain sectors of the world, which you can argue is going to create a different set of inequities. And the other thing that's going to happen, which I think, it's going to change the landscape of learning, because you'll have different cultures with different learning attitudes starting to dominate softwares and discourse. Right now, it's really North American and European dominated. But I'm starting to see some changes happening, particularly in China. Some people will say they're being North Americanized, and I would say wait another decade and we may see a reverse start to happen as well. Don't know what the outcome is, but it's worth talking about and thinking about. And of course, we know all the issues about the cost of ICT services are falling rapidly. The general quote that people use, or the examples, is the lowest price of ICT services relative to income is Singapore, Hong Kong, Luxembourg, Denmark, UK. Well, it shouldn't surprise you that some of these are very, very small jurisdictions. It's, I think what you have to do is also look at other factors in determining price structures. I mean, Canada has an incredible set of geography to take care of, which is not going to be ever as cheap, although our status as one of the most expensive places in the world isn't one that I would support either. And then, of course, AU and a lot of other institutions are now doing mobile learning, and in fact, the move towards mobile learning is big in Africa especially, and it's growing in Asia. The research that's being done at Athabasca University, to me, is leading edge and very important. I would say that in my observations, and I'm very privileged to see what's going on around the world, is that in those countries where mobile devices are increasing in numbers aggressively, there's also a resistance amongst the institution to mobile devices as being instruments for learning. There is almost a religious belief, a belief that this cannot work. It's not, what's your evidence? No, I don't believe it can. How can that much knowledge be on a device that small? I'm not saying that's what's said, but you can almost see it on a person's face. How can a screen that small teach me anything? Because important knowledge has to be large. There's all sorts of attitudinal issues which I find absolutely intriguing. But anyway, mobile devices, cell phones, smartphones, PDAs are the wave of the future, I believe. Major educational publishers are actually using these, and they're, I would argue, doing so very successfully. The problem with some of the uses of mobile devices is, and some of the other technologies, that it's often, as I observed, a reversion to bad past practice. For example, the sage on the stage is often what you see on a mobile device. You see the lecturer. You see that voice. You get outstanding pedagogy so that you can actually learn concepts more effectively. Now, if you look at iTunes U and some of the others, it tends to be, not uniformly, it tends to be sage on the stage. And when you're talking to senior government officials who control money in developing countries, they think it's wonderful you can get a famous professor to teach the course, so I guess I don't need to invest in any intellectual capital. That is something I hear alarmingly and too frequently, and it concerns me a lot. We haven't heard it yet in Canada, but I can see it in the back of the eyes of some of the senior politicians. You can almost see them saying, yes, we love ICTs, because why would you need 20 research chairs? Why don't you just have one? Because we'll just broadcast. And I know all the counter-arguments, and I use them all the time, but it is worrisome, and we have to marshal evidence. Mobile learning, obviously there's the book by Muhammad, and it's circulating the globe at rapid rate. It's something that I want to talk about with Athabasca University Press. It's one of the publications of that press. We're the first North American press, we argue, of the 21st century, a new one, and it's based entirely on open access principles. That is, any book in that press can be downloaded and used in teaching. That's one of the missions of the university. I was just asked this morning, for example, how can you possibly support a press? I said, well, look at it this way. 80% of our money goes to paying academic and professional salaries. And these people are doing research. They're doing new things every day. surely we have an obligation to share that with people. If a university were to spend 1% of its resources in communicating the intellectual products of its faculty, of its professionals, and I would say of its graduate students, then we would be truly transformative. In Canada, for example, the total monograph production in the entire country per year by Canadian scholarly presses is around 500. There are well over 10,000 scholars in the social sciences and humanities. So if I were a taxpayer, or I were a minister of advanced ed, or I were investing in research, I'd say, so what happens to all of that good research? Where does it end up? And the public argue they don't get the benefit of it. Well, some of it is toll-gated in journals. Some of it is in very scarce monographs. Some of it, because of the economic construct of the publishing industry, never ends up being more than a manuscript sitting in a box in an office. When we started the University AU Press, it's, well, you'll never get the manuscripts. Well, the fact is, we've never had a shortage of manuscripts. Then the thing is, you will never get the good manuscripts. Well, we've won more prizes in our few years as a press than anyone else. And so that's also not true. There is an incredible amount of productivity about this amongst the social scientists and humanists in Canada. They have an incredible lot to offer. And I think a vehicle like AU Press is just the beginning. Will we and can we do more radical things in the future? Yes. There are different models of open presses that I'd love to experiment with. But again, we have to move the press to its first version of acceptance, which I think has happened. Every book then is downloadable. The other thing is every author also has the right to do a podcast. I think we're up to date. And that's really important to some learners, because what the learners want is to identify with an author and to get an author to actually explain the thesis of his book, what motivated him, creates sort of another learning opportunity. So the press to me is a flagship of what an open university ought to do. I have talked to the Open University in the UK, and they regret having alienated their press. I've been approached by presses, for example, the UNISA Press, which is a print press, saying, well, is there any way we could partner so that African materials can be made available globally? And the reason they're interested in that, all I have to do is show them the downloads, Terry Anderson's book, or the downloads on mobile learning, or the number of speaking engagements that some of our authors are getting simply because their books are being read, they're being analyzed, they're being reviewed, they're being nominated for prizes. And so I actually think this is one of the great success stories, and I believe that open universities have to get involved in scholarly communication. There's another reason why this is important, and so very important. It's access copyright is about to engage in the greatest robbery that we have seen in moving their tariff up to possibly as much as $45 per flea, up from a minimal amount or a more nominal amount. Maybe some people say we'd settle at $18 per flea. That's still, for full-time learning or equivalent, that's still very, very high. The only way to get around that is to use open access resources. And we must devote ourselves to open access resources. At the same time, we have to admit as a community that not all of our open access resources are necessary of the quality. And our students have to always have access to the best information that's out there. But scholars devoted to open access are amongst the best in the world. We've had no problem getting senior scholars, for example, our first book on purpose, or was it our second book, was actually a book by the Tory chairholder at the University of Alberta, the most senior chairholder, who would rather see her works read and used than to make that extra few thousand dollars. So we're very, let's say, proud of that. We're proud of that transformation. We need more scholars supporting open access presses. We need more scholars considering them for submission. And we need to partner with other open access presses in the world to make sure that the voices around the world of scholars are heard. And Africa is one that I would love. Well, George can't say, well, actually, George, I just see George's comment. I haven't met too many academics that have made money off of publications. Well, I'll tell you a little story. I met a scholar once who I said, why do you take that rather perverse public view? And I won't go on any names. And he said, because it sells books. I have sold enough, this is an academic, to buy two revenue properties. How many have you sold? I said, well, I'm not into that. And he said, that's your choice, and this is my choice. So can you make money off of text? Can you make money off of books if you want to? Yes. And the other thing that academics do, the payment isn't necessarily in book royalties, it's in your annual increments. If you publish a book, it's the book that keeps on giving because you'll get a double increment or something. So there's many ways to make money off your publications. Anyway, I agree with you that most scholars who care passionately about their scholarship would rather be read than to make all that money. They would rather have increased access to knowledge, and I believe that's, as an open university, one of our missions. I'm passionate about this, as you probably know, and I don't begrudge, we haven't reached the 1% actually of our university budget going to scholarship, and I sometimes wonder when people are going to ask me, like, why aren't you on that road more aggressively? Why can't we grow more aggressively? Well, we're in a period of tightness, but still 1% of a smaller budget, still 1%. So I still believe in that as an ultimate funding solution. What's interesting is this, the number on the next slide, which connects a bit to open access publishing, is that 20% of learning is only non-traditional. That is, if you look at the number of people in the world, 150 million students that are currently enrolled, only about a significant number, but it's only about 20% are actually engaged in non-traditional learning. And we have to be more aggressive in the open access environment, and we have to be successful and aggressive, and we have to be vigilant. What I have noticed throughout the world, and this is a hobby horse I'm on, so I'll indulge myself if you will indulge me. The hobby horse I'm on is everywhere in the world I go, governments are increasing restrictions on the use of ICTs in post-secondary. Recently in Brazil, met with the secretary who I was asked to irritate, responsible for advanced education, whom I did irritate. He believed that 80% of all learning must be in classrooms, 80% of all distance learning must be in classrooms. I said, well, that's going to disadvantage virtually everyone in your country. And he said, well, you don't understand the culture. And I said, well, you don't understand the culture of the next generation and the power of ICTs. Anyway, it was at the Abed conference. You go to Malaysia, it's now the 20% rule, and X number of courses has to be done in classrooms. In China, there's still a movement to integrate distance learning and conventional learning, but there's still strong opposition to it. I think it'll take another 20 to 30 years. In India, for example, there was discussion. It hasn't happened, but discussion sometimes leads to action. That all new universities that were enacted, that got legislation, would have to be probationary universities for 5 years. So I thought, that's interesting. Are you going to get a degree, a probationary BA from a probationary university? How will that work? But more important, no new university would be allowed to offer distance learning. until after a 5-year period, until after they'd passed their probation. So think how that's going to impact India. Well, it's going to preserve the hegemony of existing distance providers, that's for sure. It's going to disadvantage literally tens of millions of people. So is that a direction they want to go? Ethiopia has just banned distance education, even though they understand the person responsible for the post-secondary environment got their degree from the Open University of the UK. And they say, well, they don't really mean it, but the fact is that's the statement. And there are reasons why they're moving in that direction. So we've got ourselves an interesting international set of events happening. In the U.S., the most recent hearings with the based really on the Phoenix and the for-profit misbehaviors are going to impact the not-for-profits that have been engaged in good practice for a long time, and they're also going to impact the public institutions because it's going to be an attack on distance learning and technology-enabled learning. So we're going to see out of the U.S. all sorts of things. Well, what's driving the resistance I can tell you what I believe is happening and why there's a question on is what's driving this resistance to DL. Well, I think it's, first of all, we're turning knowledge from a commodity of scarcity held by few people to a commodity of abundance. And once you do that, then you start, especially in developing countries, impacting the hegemony of the middle class, which is small, but whose children have basically had access to conventional institutions and they had to fight it. Well, if all of a sudden we can prove, which we can, that the quality of learning through a distance institution is as good, if not better, than conventional institutions, and all of a sudden this new group of people, which will be double the previous cohort, because if we move from 150 to 300 million, all of a sudden you're going to have people who feel threatened, whose jobs for their children are threatened, whose own hegemony in their country is threatened. I was recently in a country where they had spent a lot of money in literacy, and I was seriously asked, I mean, I was shocked, but I was asked the question, is we all of a sudden have a lot of now women who are literate. What do we do with them? And I thought, you know, bang my head on a wall. It's well, have you thought about health education? Have you thought about, you know, child rearing? Have you thought about small business education? What a question. But I think that question underlies a lot of fears. And I think that's possibly the fear in Ethiopia. If all of a sudden we have an educated, questioning group of people, they may demand social change. They may demand change in social structures. They may demand change in government. And I think that underlies some of this. It's kind of frightening, but I think we have to be cognizant of what's going on. The question on blended learning, blended learning has been accepted by some institutions, and those institutions that exercise hegemony are not foolish. There are two things that they will do when they see evidence. They will engage in blended learning, but some cases blended learning, the definition changes from week to week, month to month. The other thing that has happened is that distance education is seen as an ancillary service that can be used to generate revenues to support conventional practices. If I go around the world and people say, well, our university's doing distance, I'm saying, well, that's great. So how are you supporting it? What's your models? And basically it's, I would say, a projected sage on the stage, the image with some educational supports, And it's generally because of the various rules governments have, it's outside tuition policy, so it's then the revenue generator. It's not core to mission. It's not core to a mission of social change. It's not core to massification. And, you know, Peggy, you asked, so I see the resistance to DL in the developed world. Unfortunately, yes, it's coming out of the U.S. One of the, if you consider the U.S. a developed country, there's intellectual development as well as, you know, economic development. I shouldn't go there, but yes, it is. In fact, the U.S. 3-4 years ago, under HERA, the Higher Education, I think it's Reform Act. It's called. Americans can no longer get government funding to take learning from distance education providers in foreign countries. So, for example, an American student could not take an Athabasca University course and get a student loan for doing that. Now, this disadvantages the disabled who can't travel, or people who economic circumstance can't travel. But then there's a belief by many in the U.S. you can't be internationalized through distance learning, which again I refute. It's absolutely not true. So, you know, it's this is serious business. The ICD, the International Council of Distance Ed, has commissioned a major study on the increasing restrictions on distance learning, what it's doing, how it's going to impact the use of ICTs, how it's going to impact the massification of knowledge, how it's going to impact economic development. And again, looking at very clearly, I have my suspicions of why it's going on, but why is this really going on? I personally think, of course I would think I've got it right, but anyway. And then it's, and I've said this, and this just moves us along, is that a lot of OERs that I've seen are replicating existing pedagogical forms. The MITs of the world and some of the stuff out of California, some of it is just replicating what I call Sage on the Stage. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there are many, many, many better methods of using technology for learning. We believe at Athabasca, I believe from what I've seen around the world, that the next generation of learners are demanding an aggressive, sophisticated, socially based, e-based pedagogy. If you want to see where there's something radical has happened, it's actually happening in Spain, where for the first time they've seen a major demographic shift. Like generally our demographic is the 28, 29 year olds. They're seeing the 18 year olds. They would rather learn online. They would rather learn in a sophisticated e-environment than in a classroom. And so they're the first country that's seen this shift. Now, trying to find out exactly what is it about that particular culture that has let that or encouraged that to happen. At Athabasca, we are engaged in some interesting activities, and got to talk about my favorite one as well, which is the world's best first year online, which is trying to take 12 courses common around the world online in what I call embed the pedagogy, so that from knowing very little, you can work your way through it to having a competency which we would consider the highest of any first year institution. The intention is put it online, give it away, do what you want with it, use it. If you as a developing country want to adopt the entire curriculum, go for it. If you don't, that's fine too. What we hope through Canada's Virtual University, which is the entity sponsoring it with Athabasca University as the lead, that students might then go to university and seek tutorial support for that learning, which might lead to a credential for that learning through challenge exams, if that's the route that's going. But the intention is to, the learning object, it will be more than the learning object, it will be a series of learning objects so that someone can actually go through the entire thing themselves. That's much learning, and some of the pedagogy people are better at this obviously than I am. But what this in calculus, what it will do is that it'll embed the self-examination in every step of the way. So it's you practice, you learn. The more you learn, the deeper the questions. The more you learn, the deeper the questions again. So it's about learning through self-appreciation and testing as distinct from learning through what some people might be examination. Anyway, it's much learning, and they have good design principles, and we are active with them. And this slide describes much of what they're doing. And here's some of the slides, and all of you who are involved in this know I'm preaching to the converted. It's the moment you start having a more progressive pedagogy using online intervention, whether it's blended learning, whether it's a fully online learning, your success rates start to go up. This is all in, yes, and I know she's a self-promoter, but it's all in Carol Twigg's studies. And what's happened in many of the U.S. institutions is well documented. None of this is a surprise. It's not a surprise to me. But, you know, everywhere I go, you still have to persuade people in the conventional institutions, and I was going to say the conventional hegemonic institutions, because that's what they are, that this actually does work. And I think it's starting to happen, but generally it's evidenced and practiced from younger faculty. So this is this is moving. Our much learning thing is moving ahead. Yeah, they're involved in much learning is involved in a number of things, and I think Terry and others can provide some of the coordinates for them if people are interested. Well, so could I. And the whole movement globally is going to the mass individualization of learning. I mean, again, we all know that it's part of who we are, and it's the culture of distance learning. And as I've said, and this is where I despair, both in province, Canada-wide, despair what's happening in the U.S., despair what's happening internationally. And, the despair, yes, the deep root is, I believe, the fundamental reason why there's opposition. It's the turning of knowledge from a commodity that is scarce, that people use for control, to one that's abundant, that makes everyone realize their own capacity in life. The biggest weapon that's being used around the world, and Phoenix has not helped us, is, well, it's not quality, you know. I mean, so everything in the world, all actions are masked under the quality agenda. We're there to protect our students. So, but is that the real motive? Because you can use all of the evidence to show, no, learning is actually more effective, the outcomes are better, and yet it's, well, you don't understand our culture, because you can only get quality in a classroom. And so you have to be at it and at it. What I've been trying to do through ICD and also in the Alberta context is get a quality conversation going between the, what I call the distance ed or the opening learning providers, and those at the conventional university. Because if you believe, and I believe, and you can argue that I'm a fool, that evidence-based arguments do ultimately win, and that if you bring in distance ed providers together with those from a more conventional background, they will see truth, justice, light. And in fact, recently in Alberta, we had a meeting of those people interested in the quality agenda in distance education. We had people from the Alberta Quality Council there as well. I'd say that some people from the beginning thought, well, maybe we have to have different quality criteria for distance learning than for conventional learning. Well, you may have different process criteria, but the outcome ought to be the same. I mean, a person either knows a subject or doesn't, or a person has, knows how to investigate issues or doesn't. And they agreed that it really what matters are outcomes. And then we have to determine what do we want in our graduates, what do we want in learning, whether they're graduates or not, and then how to most effectively achieve those outcomes. And I think the decision that distance education was as good as and that they should be tested against the same measures, I thought was a step forward. I know some people would say, maybe that's not the best way to go and that we should enjoy our separateness. I say if we go that route, we will see ourselves marginalized. So I think the dialogue in the next 2 or 3 years is going to be the quality dialogue. The dialogue, we may choose not to participate in it, but I can tell you that governments are involved everywhere in it. They still hold the instruments of regulation, and I think it behooves us to be involved in that debate, to be aggressive in that debate, to take no prisoners in that debate, and to win that debate, and I know we will. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, I've said we've got to accept the challenge. We have to embrace the new world, which I know we all will. We have to, I'd say, storm the barricades and remove the barriers. And that's about it. So, up the revolution, as I say. So if there's any questions, I'd be delighted.
I want to take a moment before you're bombarded with questions, Fritz, and thank you so much for sharing all of your knowledge on what's going on globally with the open access movement and distance education. It's certainly enlightening. And I don't know if you got a chance to read all the conversation that was scrolling along, but you certainly stimulated a lot of discussion here. And I know it's going to continue over the next few minutes, so I wanted to jump in and thank you now. And I also just wanted to state that we have a winner on the draw, and that is, Santiev 2004. So Santiev 2004, if you can send your email address to Colin Elliott, he will make sure that you get your coffee mug and t-shirt. So congratulations on that, and I'll just open the floor for questions and comments to Fritz.
Well, thanks, Fritz. I'll jump in. It's Terry. I think that one of the issues that gets raised is really a fundamental one about who are the universities or even the colleges for. And I think that if we were to ask students about their acceptance of distance education, especially those who are voting with their pocketbooks and their time and energy, you can see the student numbers increasing. If we were to ask most employers now, I think they're starting to realize the self-direction and the resilience that comes with doing online students. But if you were to ask the faculty members, they got into teaching and learning in higher ed because they like teaching and learning in higher ed, or at least they like researching and having the capacity to do that, and which doesn't have much to do with DE either. So I guess one of the big problems is just, how does everyone get to decide, what the type and the model of programming is? Or are we sort of, the self-governance of universities is a long and hallowed tradition, but what happens when that self-government doesn't govern in the interests of the people, if you like? I think it's breeding grounds for revolution, and I would hate to see it destroy the universities. I wonder if you have any comment on that.
Actually, I think that's one of the worries, and that's why if you look at behind who's pushing for the regulation, the regulations in most of the countries is being pushed for by traditional universities. And why are they interested in preserving their position? Because really that's the way I see it. And will they be successful? Actually, they're being very successful in preserving their hegemony. Now, what's really interesting is what's happening in China, where Now, if you were a university that has got a large war chest and you got a lot of money and you see yourself perhaps being threatened by distance learning, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to buy out or absorb that other institution, because an open and distance institution tends to be, most parts of the world, not everywhere, but probably a tad more fiscally fragile. So what I saw happening last time I was in China is the takeover of one of the RTVs by one of the prestige institutions. Now, you could say, well, that, is that a good or a bad thing? Well, I guess it depends. And part of me says, ah, there'll be reform from within. And do I really care whether one of the prestige institutions starts to use a technology and understands digital environments and starts to massify learning using its brand? Hey, maybe that's okay. or maybe not. It depends on what the rate of transformation is. I suspect that once a smaller institution like a distance institution is absorbed into a major one, you will tend to see a slowdown of reform. I look at some of the places in the world where those universities have been absorbed, and you can look at Canadian examples too. And in some cases, reform has changed. The freedom to move is gone. You've got the old conventions that are then engaged in restraint of innovation. I mean, it's extraordinarily complex, and so I take the complex and reduce it down to the simple, and I just say, I actually believe people are busy preserving their social and economic status in the developing world and in this country as well. And that's normal behavior, and it's our job to continue. But if you even ask yourself, look in the mirror, okay, if we doubled the number of PhDs in this country, or people with that kind of level of learning, would we all be prepared for triple the number of people going after jobs? That's a belief. Well, some of us reply, well, there'd be more jobs, so what are you worried about? Because you're going to have more learners. But there is a concern about that. We increase the number, we increase competitiveness, and this is not necessarily good. We want to control our future. It's complex. Anyway, if there are any other questions, I'm sort of watching some of the conversations that are going on. Quick question. What's the cost of restraining innovation? I think it's huge. I think for a developing country, it's relegating that country back almost several generations of innovation. Brazil is hugely innovative, and they've done wonders in things with agriculture and in non-traditional learning. What will happen, and that's a good question, what happens in some countries is then learning takes place outside the credentialed world, and learning is going to be inside sort of a freer environment, a non-credentialed world, and we may see people realizing their future in that. And maybe that's okay, but the positions of status in government, in institutions, in elected officials, etc., may be then left to those with more conventional credentials because we still believe in them. Anyway, it's interesting, and I agree with you, Doug. Focus should be on achievement of learning outcomes. It should be everywhere. It's not the number of hours in a seat. And this is what they're still trying to do in parts of Asia. It's the number of hours in a seat. So my response at one point to someone who said, well, how do you know they're learning? I said, well, how do you know someone sitting in a classroom of 600 who is asleep is learning? I mean, is education in the air? Is it something you breathe in that particular environment? So, you know, there's still an incredible amount of resistance. And you know, Joanna, I agree, people will go outside the credential restraints, except where employers want to manage the authenticity of knowledge. And so if you say, well, an employer is going to manage the authentication of knowledge, which they may well do, then you may have the removal of a public sphere of learning to a private sphere. And to me, who believes, and I believe strongly in public education, it could be very dangerous. I think we have to be very concerned that education is a public, I believe it's a public right, I believe it's a public good, and I think we have to think this through very carefully. Yeah, and looking at Doug is what you're saying, and Joanne's saying is, I actually believe that the teacher is probably wrong. It's co-learner these days. I mean, I still tutor three courses, and I would say increasingly, what I enjoy about it is students know an incredible amount, and you're always engaged in co-learning, and the more learning you do with others, the richer you become and the richer they become. So actually being long in the tooth is becoming a good thing because knowledge is there to be shared, but it's also there to be internalized. But it's what I see increasingly, and this is where I like Joanne's comment, education again is a public right. And where governments are regulating education, they're also not investing in learning. This is the dichotomy. In China, for example, incredible system, but it's all tuition paid. The state does not invest in it. The state regulates it. The same in Brazil. If you look at public education is now a minority, it's the big expansion has been public education. Private education, that's where all the expansion is. So what is government involved in? Is in regulation, again. But it's they regulate method of learning, but they don't regulate outcomes. And it's, I just see it's, we have to be very aggressive. We have to be, we have to be out there in public. We have to engage decision makers. Because if we don't, I think that ICTs will be used for informal learning increasingly, and the hegemony of the conventional universities will continue, and I believe that's not a good thing. So, anyway, one doesn't want to be in a state of despair, but that's what I sometimes come to. Anyway, any comments from anyone? I'll just turn it over to whomever.
This is Alan Selig. I received a lesson in Canadian history yesterday, which I valued very much. I had never known before that October the 18th was Person Day. I don't know how generally it's celebrated, but the idea that it should take a group of women 8 or 10 years back in the early part of the 20th century to get political officials to acknowledge that they were indeed persons, even though they were functioning already in positions like magistrates and serving in lots of different ways. Maybe that's almost a hopeful thing. I wonder if there isn't often a backlash against effective movements and progress in societies, and simply needs to be acknowledged, and those who are in support of the changes and developments continue to move forward, recognizing but not despairing, because there will often be backlashes and negative reactions and attempts to legislate former patterns and realities.
I don't disagree with you. I think there are some signs of hope, but at the same time, where I think the open learn movement, the OER movement, all the subsets of the movement, which is a tad fragmented, have to be very vigilant about what's going on in the U.S. right now in Washington, because there's going to be more restrictive legislation than you can imagine. And when that market, which is often the market where you see radical change happening, when that is the restrictions on particularly student loans, on government financing, on government support starts to happen, behaviors will start to change. What you might see is the beginnings of a European movement which is more Eurocentric, because they seem to have their act together a bit more. We don't see in Europe as many restrictions on the use of OERs, or the use of open learning. So they may take a leadership role, which isn't a bad thing. I think Canada can still exercise leadership. I mean, we've always been fragmented. We always, because we're provincially based, we can have influence over ministries. In case of Athabasca, I say we fought the fight over the last about 5, 6, 7 years, and I believe that we are now considered, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but we're more considered to be a valid instrument of government policy that's part of the whole, you know, learning ecosystem, and that we're a valid and respected player. That hasn't happened overnight. But I think in Canada, provincially, we've managed to score some successes. But now how do we position ourselves globally? Canada's lost its international brand, sort of. But we can recapture it.
I've been trying to keep up with the text, but it's scrolling through pretty quickly. So if we've missed any questions that have gone through, please feel free to either retype them or grab the microphone and let us know what your question is.
I noticed that Marie said students, having been educated entirely in conventional universities until, you know, later when one becomes self-taught, which is just as good because I figured I was self-taught in conventional anyway, is students learn at different paces. And I actually believe that some students can take a full 6-credit course that some people may take a year to absorb, that they can actually absorb it within a 2-month period or a 1-month period. In fact, there's some studies that show intense learning in a 6-week period, what I call a boot camp environment, whether it's an online boot camp or a real boot camp, that learning can be more effective. There's a study done at Brock University recently on their boot camp where they actually hauled students in for doing the 6-credit course in 3 weeks, and then they did studies, or it was 2 weeks, whatever it was very intense. Then they did studies about retention of students who had taken over the normal period of time, and those students who had been involved in that really intense learning, the students in that intense learning actually had greater retention over time. So I think we have to be, you know, aware that many different things are going on and there's many different opportunities, and decisions should be based on evidence, not on our personal experience or beliefs, which I'll admit I still often say this is what happened to me. But the question is Brazil the only innovative country in Latin America with respect to DE? Well, depends on what you call innovation. Argentina would argue that there's innovation there, and some of the others would argue innovation. But some of the new legislation in some of Latin America is basically putting restrictions on distance learning. And ICD was asked recently, I believe, by Ecuador to write a passionate plea to their president to stop the legislation which would limit distance learning in that country. I've seen some of the worst practice and some of the best practice. So anyway, I keep seeing things scrolling by, but the one could go on forever, and I leave our moderator to determine what to do.
Thank you, Fritz. I was just looking at the clock, and we've held you captive for an hour now, as promised, and I'm sure it could go on forever, but I will cap this session by inviting everybody to join us again tomorrow for Dr. Rory McGreal's session on open educational resources and copyright. And thank you once again, Fritz, for joining us here today and for a very stimulating conversation. I've also mentioned the recordings for this session will be available on the Open Access Week site. The link is there on the screen, and I'll post it in the text box. So feel free to pass that along to anyone who wasn't able to make it here today. And thank you to everyone for joining us.